Full Story is supported by Telstra. Big ambitions need the right partner, and that's where Telstra comes in. Telstra works with enterprise and government organisations across Australia to help them build, connect, and grow at scale. They support real outcomes, from secure business growth to connecting schools to networks that help keep communities safe. Telstra is a long-term partner for organisations with complex needs and big plans. Together builds better, wherever they go. For enterprise-sized solutions, partner with Telstra.
Will, thanks for joining us on Full Story.
Thanks for having me.
You are in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. What is it like there at the moment?
It's a bit unreal. It feels like a sense of deja vu, and it feels similar to the war that happened in 2024. As you walk the streets of the city, you see people sleeping rough. There's over a million displaced people in the country, and it's evident as you walk the streets. There are strikes throughout the day, even in areas that were thought of as safe. Yesterday, there was a strike in the Hazmiya neighborhood, which is a Christian majority neighborhood. And at first, people heard a noise, but they didn't think it was a strike. They thought maybe it was a gas canister exploding, but then it turned out to be a drone strike, assassinating a member of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. So it's a very unreal feeling in the capital now.
Mm. As you mentioned, a million people have been forced out of their homes, displaced from villages in the south of the country, but also neighbourhoods in Beirut. What is it like on the streets? How are people holding up?
I think it's very tough. Like you said, big parts of Beirut, the southern suburbs, which hosts up to 500,000 people, have been forced out of their homes. To give a sense of scale, you know, a million people in Lebanon is 1 out of 5 people in the country, which is one of the world's biggest displacement crises now in a very small country. And in a country where the government has been insolvent for years, the banking sector doesn't work. You know, in the best of times, it's a dysfunctional country. So out of a million people, only about 10% of those are in shelters. The rest are either sleeping rough or making do how they can. So it's a very tense atmosphere, especially because unfortunately, this time around, this war, there's not a lot of sympathy for the displaced. There's a feeling among those who aren't Shia that Hezbollah dragged the country into war and its supporters brought this upon themselves. So there's growing social tensions as well.
Mm. You recently travelled through southern parts of the country which are being hardest hit by Israel. Can you tell me about that experience and what you saw while you were there?
Yes, yeah, so we were in the city of Tyre, which is one of the largest cities in southern Lebanon. And while we were there, you know, we arrived in the morning and I was surprised to see that something like 20% of the population was still there. Shops were still open. Despite the occasional airstrike and rubble strewn streets, people were still there. But by the end of the night, Israel had issued another displacement order specifically for the city of Sur'ud. And that was sort of a terrifying experience to go through because you saw the panic on people's faces as they realized that they had to get out. And many of these people had already been displaced from villages further south. You know, we heard shooting in the air, and by morning, the city had been almost entirely emptied out. There's still some people remaining there, but since then, Israel has been steadily carving off the south of the country. They've been hitting bridges all over the country, cutting off those villages and cities south of the Litani River from the rest of the country and stranding civilians there. We also went to the city of Nabatieh, which is even more of a ghost town. You know, it's a city of almost 100,000. And when we went there, there was probably about 100 people there. And we spent some time in the hospitals there. And despite there not being many people, there was lots of wounded. We were told by medics that displaced people left their homes and then went to Beirut, didn't find any shelter, went back to their homes. And then as they did, many of them were hit by Israeli airstrikes. So it's a very grim situation.
I want to ask you about those who decided to stay. As you mentioned, that many have been scarred by previous wars with Israel. They would have left their villages, but some have chosen to stay. Why? What did they tell you about their reason for staying in their homes, in their villages?
You know, many of the people that are staying either are, you know, elderly or unable to leave. Others, like I said, they tried to flee and they tried to go further north, but they didn't find any shelter and they didn't find people willing to accommodate them. So they decided to go back to their homes and just stay there, whatever may come. And we covered the case of one family who decided to stay because they couldn't find any shelter in Beirut. And an Israeli airstrike hit their family home and killed them, their kids, and their grandparents as well. And then on top of that, you have medics who are staying put. You know, as you drive through the south, it does feel very eerie because it feels like a ghost town. But as you drive through the villages, what you're seeing oftentimes are medics waiting for strikes. And they rush to the sites wherever they are to evacuate wounded people.
You have been reporting on the Israeli attacks on medical facilities. How many of those sites have been targeted and what are healthcare workers telling you?
We've seen over 128 attacks on healthcare facilities and ambulances. We've seen 40 healthcare workers killed and even more wounded. What healthcare workers and Lebanese officials have been saying is that many of these are deliberate attacks on these facilities, and in some cases, double-tap strikes. We were told that by first responders that they're seeing a pattern that's emerging, that someone gets hit, and as soon as the medics show up to evacuate them, the same spot gets bombed again, killing the medics. Another grim pattern that they've noticed is that Israel will often wait for medics to gather for iftar, the meal that breaks the fast during Ramadan, the month that just ended. And then they strike ambulances or medical facilities when people gather. And in response to that, medics have been adopting tactics to try to reduce the damage as much as they can. They are sleeping in ambulances parked far away from one another so that if there's a single strike on a medical center or an ambulance, it doesn't kill all of them at once. They're not letting family or friends visit them during working hours, as they're aware they are targets. And they're reducing the size of medical teams when they respond to strikes because they know there might be double tap strikes. So better to have two people rather than three get caught up in them. And also, you know, it's just, you know, I asked one of them, I said, how can you do this job when you know you might be a target when you're sitting there under the drone? And he said, you know, you just can't think about it or else you start to spiral. He said, it does feel like we're just sitting here like sitting ducks.
Mm. The Israeli military has accused Hezbollah of using ambulances for military purposes, but you have gone and visited some of these sites and inspected the wreckage from these vehicles. What did you see?
I saw a destroyed ambulance, I saw a destroyed medical site, I saw medical equipment, I saw plates, I saw cutlery, I saw a couch. I didn't see any evidence of military activity. And this is an accusation they made during the last war as well, without providing evidence. This is an accusation they made during the Gaza war, oftentimes without providing evidence. International human rights law is clear that any medic, regardless of political affiliation, is considered a civilian unless they're actively facilitating military activity. And these medics are not, you know, they're medics and they're clear about that. They've said that if they wanted to be fighters, they'd sign up to be fighters. And the idea that they could work a full-time job as a medic during a war and at the same time be a soldier or a fighter is one that's hard to believe. But again, you know, we asked the Israeli military specifically about the sites we visited. We gave them coordinates. We asked them why they struck them. And we asked them for evidence for their claim that they're being used for military purposes. And they didn't answer.
The United Nations says that these Israeli strikes on medical sites and other civilian infrastructure may constitute war crimes. Why is Israel bombing bridges along the Leitani River? And how is that affecting the lives of civilians and aid?
So the explanation that Israel is using is that they are bombing the bridges over the Litani River because they're trying to cut off the supply lines to Hezbollah. Right now, Israel is engaged in ground fighting with Hezbollah in the areas south of Litani. So they say that they use the bridges to move south. But again, international humanitarian law says you can't strike public infrastructure. You can't target public infrastructure such as bridges. And, you know, for the 30,000 civilians or so in the city of Tyr, for example, cutting off those bridges means those people are stranded there. It means they won't have access to food or aid in the coming days. You know, if someone's hit in a strike and they need advanced care, the only burn unit in Lebanon is in Beirut. It's not in Tyr. So getting them there, who knows how they're going to do that? It could be a humanitarian catastrophe. And there's also long-term consequences to think of. I mean, the hitting of 7 bridges across the country is effectively cutting off about 10% of the country, and it's leading to fears of long-term annexation by the Israeli government.
Well, Israeli officials have invoked Gaza when they talk about their plans for Lebanon. What do we know about what is happening on the front line and just how intense the fighting is between Hezbollah and Israeli troops?
So it's hard to get an exact accurate picture without actually being there. And these are hard to access areas now, particularly with the bridges being struck. But what we know is that there is intense fighting in the border villages, and particularly there was intense fighting in the hilltop city of Khiam. Recent images and videos seem to show that the Israelis have advanced into the town past Hezbollah fighters after weeks of fighting. It's hard to tell, but you know, there's recent images and videos of Israelis conducting controlled demolitions in the city, which would imply that they have enough time and they feel that they have enough control of the city to be able to do that. So what we know is that Hezbollah is putting up a fierce fight, but they're fighting against one of the most well-equipped and advanced militaries in the region, if not the world. So it seems likely that their ability to control the south is not going to be one that lasts for long.
I want to ask you a bit more about that, because Hezbollah suffered some big blows back in 2024. Many said that it had been severely weakened. You've mentioned just there that they're putting on a fierce fight, that there is stiff resistance. Has that come as a surprise to you and to others in Lebanon?
It has, because like you said, in the 13-month war that ended in November 2024, Hezbollah suffered very intense losses. The head of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, was killed. Most of its senior military and political leadership was killed, and thousands of fighters were either wounded or killed. And so people thought of the group as one that was on its back foot, and certainly it's one that's weakened. But nonetheless, somehow Hezbollah has managed to launch 700 rockets into Israel, something that continues daily over the last few weeks. And somehow its fighters have managed to resist the incursion of Israeli forces into the south for at least 3 weeks. And the way they're doing this is having sort of placed hundreds of decentralized independent units in each villages along the border in wait for something like this. But also, you know, something to think about is there's different definitions of victory here. For Israel, the goal they've put for victory, the goalpost they've put to say we've won this war, is completely destroying Hezbollah, which is not just an armed militia, but also a group that is ideologically rooted in Lebanon and enjoys wide support from large parts of the population. For Hezbollah, victory is just surviving. So even if they lose thousands of fighters, even if they lose the south, if they manage to emerge still standing after this war, they'll consider it a victory.
Earlier you mentioned that in parts of the country, there's not a huge amount of sympathy for the Shia community from southern Lebanon who form much of Hezbollah's base. The Israeli military has not only ordered the destruction of bridges in Lebanon, but also homes in some of those border villages. Israel's finance minister says that the Leitani River must be the new Israeli border. What's been the reaction to comments like that amongst the Lebanese people?
Yeah, it's something that's terrifying. You know, people watched what happened in Gaza, and most of the world saw it as a war that was fought in a repulsive way, you know, in an insanely high civilian death toll among the women and children, and just wanton destruction of homes and infrastructure. You know, the Guardian coined a term, domicide, to describe the destruction of homes in such a systemic way in Gaza. But it seems like for Israel, this was not a aberration or something that they regret, but actually a playbook that they want to replicate. And, you know, Israeli officials have made direct reference to Gaza in their statements about Lebanon. The Israeli defense minister of the weekend says that they want to enact what they did in Beit Hanun and Rafah, two cities in Gaza that have been essentially razed in South Lebanon. So among the residents of southern Lebanon, you know, there's a sense of terror that now that they've been expelled from their homes, they'll never be able to go back, that this area might be annexed forever, that this buffer zone that the Israeli military is describing that they want to establish will come at the expense of their own land and their own homes.
We'll be right back.